Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Glad to be with us today. It is Thursday, and I am just moving a little bit slow today because, oh my goodness, George Springer is not a religious deity. But in Houston, he could be, because last night he gave the Astros after his two-run homer to right center field in the top of the 11th inning, gave the Astros their first win in a World Series game in 56 seasons of franchise history. So the series is now tied 1-1, and it's going to be exciting. I know it's going to be a fun weekend for baseball, and it's going to be a wild World Series this year. So anyway, welcome to the show. Well, we've got a great show coming up. Jana Magruder is going to be with us in just a few minutes. She is an author and director of Lifeway Kids. She's written a book called Nothing Less, Engaging Kids in a Lifetime of Faith. And there are a lot of reasons that kids are moving away from their faith. And she's going to encourage us and give us some hints as to how to keep our kids grounded in faith and some of the 10 greatest things to do for your kids and for the spiritual health of your kids. So that's going to be coming up. And then my friend Dr. Peter Kapsner is going to be with us. I recently paid the Russians $6 for the dossier on Peter Kapsner. And I think I got ripped off because I got nothing. So it is 6 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and get Jana on the phone. We're looking forward to our conversation about her book called Nothing Less, Engaging the Kids in a Lifetime of Faith. Be back in a minute. Good morning once again. It is 7 minutes after the hour. Jana Magruder is an author. She has written a book called Nothing Less, Engaging Kids in a Lifetime of Faith. And we're going to talk this morning about the 10 great influencers of spiritual health for kids. And she is on our studio line now. Good morning, Jana.
Good morning. Great to be with y'all this morning.
Thank you. It is rise and shine, isn't it? Where do you live?
Nashville, Tennessee, so it is not rise and shine yet. It is dark.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your work, your book, Nothing Less, Engaging Kids in a Lifetime of Faith. Obviously, we want our kids to know God and grow in their relationship with Him, but evil is everywhere, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So what are some of the things that we see? What are the trends? I mean, some kids are saying, you know, yeah, it was nice growing up in a Christian home, but I'm not that interested in church anymore.
Right. And so, well, the research that we conducted actually talks to parents. We actually surveyed 2,000 parents who are on the other end of raising kids. So their children are already out of the home and are young adults. So that was the criteria. And then the parents that were surveyed are also considered themselves church-attending Christians. So that's important to know. So what we really set out to do was to ask that question of parents who maybe kind of got it right in every sense of the word. Like, what happened? What did you do that could have? Could we statistically find some things in common mm-hmm. with these parents whose children were walking with the Lord as adults? And so that's what we set out to do. And we found some commonalities, actually. That were working. So by far, statistically, I'll just go ahead and give the biggest one, if that's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I've got my pen out. I'm ready to write it down.
Yeah, it's going to blow your mind.
Okay.
Man. Okay.
Blow it.
Okay, listeners, are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. The child regularly read their Bible growing up.
Ding, 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 ding. No further calls.
Yes.
Stop taking calls.
Exactly.
We have a winner.
Exactly. And so for us that were involved in the study, we're all parents, and we still got kids at home, and I've got a 10-year-old, 12-year-old, and 15-year-old, and so I was just, you know, waiting for this magic formula that perhaps I could do, and it all comes down to that is the number one indicator statistically by far. Now, there are others, but this one just is so far off the charts compared to the other ones that it just stood out really in a profound way. So I know it sounds like the church answer, and we're kind of all looking at ourselves like, well, duh, you know, read the Bible. But what the study finds out is that we're chasing lots of other different things.
Yeah,
instead of the Bible.
Jana, let me read this verse out of Hebrews chapter 4, a familiar one in verse 12. For the word of God is alive and active, sharper than any double-edged sword. It penetrates even to dividing soul and spirit, joints and marrow. It judges the thoughts and attitudes of the heart.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we know that God's word transforms. And we as parents, as much as we want to modify behavior, we really aren't going to get very far until we can get to the heart, and we know that really only God's word is what transforms hearts.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that it would be the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jana, what about does level of involvement with community? I mean, you know, kids, friends are everything. So did that show up in some of your research as how connected kids are with other kids growing up? Is that another factor?
Well, you know, we have our indicators, and then we have what did not make the list. And what did not make the list are a lot of things that we as parents chase, including, like, we need our friends to have a certain, friend group. We need to make sure they're extra involved. I mean, that's for us Gen X parents and millennial parents.
Mm-hmm.
That involvement is extremely important. The next portion of the list is what I would say has a moderate impact.
Okay.
But that was things like child regularly spent time in prayer, child regularly served in church while growing up. Now, that's different than just attending. So serving is a huge deal. And we all know as parents that if children are serving, that usually means you're serving with them. And so I think that's a wake-up call for us as parents who are consuming at church,
mm-hmm,
to start serving in church so that our children can see that, so that that's modeling behavior, and then also they can come along. I know that I have a children's ministry background, and that's who, you know, we're trying to help equip as a children's minister to help equip their parents. And you know, we all know as church attenders, who's always asking for volunteers the most?
Mm-hmm.
It's the kids leaders, and a lot of times it's preschool leaders. And so my daughter is 15, and so she's allowed to serve alongside me. And we, will take care of the preschoolers at the 11 o'clock service so that their parents can go to church. And it's a delight. And, you know, we do it together, and my daughter gets to practice reading stories and telling Bible stories and singing with kids and things like that. Those are things that that will stick with her. And I know that that's how it happened for me as a child too. So number four on the moderate impact list is that this statistically showed up that the child listened primarily to Christian music. So for some of us, that was kind of a surprise because, I don't know, for those of us who grew up in a generation where it is a little legalistic, like burn all your secular CDs, come to the altar. I mean, there was a program even, I think, that you know, you had to surrender all your secular CDs or cassette tapes and things like that. And we feel like we've now, you know, gotten a handle on, you know, grace, and as long as it's not profanity, you know, secular music's fine. Well, this is telling us that it really does make a difference, that That was kind of a surprise. Made the list. Mm-hmm. It has an impact.
So
am
I kind of a freak being a Christian today, having grown up on 70s rock?
You would not be alone, because most of us that were a part of this study were kind of hoping, I hope that doesn't make the list because we're not doing a great job of this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of Taylor Swift in my kids' iTunes, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Just to be honest.
Yeah.
I think it has an impact going back to that number one impact, which is the Bible. And so if you're listening to lyrics that are rich in biblical doctrine,
mm-hmm.
I think that it slides into that category because of that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily just Christian music that doesn't have a lot of, you know, deep biblical lyrics.
Right.
I'd love to double click that and do another study, but for now, that's all we have. The last one on the moderate list I'll mention, because I think it's really neat, is that the child participated in church mission trips and projects. And so any of us who have been on a mission trip know that it deeply, affected us in our spiritual walk. And so if we can provide those kinds of experiences for families to start doing in some way, it doesn't mean you have to go to Africa, but just some way involve themselves in mission, whether that's just locally in their communities, praying for missionaries, giving to missionaries, being involved in their church mission initiatives, and then, you know, think about going someday as well. So
mm-hmm.
those are the largest is the Bible, and then those are the four moderate, and then we have a list of smallest impact.
Okay, Jana, we're off to a great start. Let me take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jana Magruder. She's written a book that called Nothing Less, Engaging Kids in a Lifetime of Faith. It is 16 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. Good morning. It's 18 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Jana Magruder. She's written a book called Nothing Less, Engaging Kids in a Lifetime of Faith. Jana, this is an interesting conversation. I want to talk a little bit about the highlight of the book is get your kids involved in Bible study and then also lead them to prayer. But where do kids learn about how to pray? And do we do a good job talking to our kids about prayer and unanswered prayer? And how are we doing in that department?
Well, the book really dives into the importance of parents really being the primary disciplers of their child. And then the church coming alongside that primary discipleship role. So, we just finished a conference in Nashville called ETCH, and ETCH stands for Equipping the Church and Home. And so we're big believers in that it is both. A lot of times, though, 30 years ago, you know, we kind of thought we put the Sunday school teacher or the children's minister as the primary discipler of our kids, you know,
mm-hmm.
and really we're trying, trends are showing that, well, first of all, it's not biblical. If you look at Deuteronomy 6, you know, you're supposed to teach your children. It says grandparents, parents, teach your children these things as you go along the way. And so we really want to make sure the church's role is to make sure that parents really are equipped to have, first of all, encourage them in their prayer life, teach them about prayer, and let them experience prayer in worship and in fellowship with other believers. And then that translates to the home and trickles down to the home. So that they can pray with their children first, you know, and model, and then eventually have their, you know, children, we want them to own their own faith, especially once they've made that decision to follow Christ as their own Savior. So, the parents have a huge role, and the church can come alongside them in that.
Now, I think in your book, Jana, you did cite 8 observable factors that parents can do. And maybe we can talk about those. Obviously, don't wear embarrassing clothes, but what besides that?
In terms of what parents can do with prayer?
No, what parents can do to help the spiritual health of their children, like identify as a Christian and share their faith with unbelievers. And
yes. There are specific things that parents can do. I I am wanting to make sure that we're talking about the same list, so bear with me just for a second.
No problem.
Do you have the book in front of you?
I do not have the book. I have some of the research in front of me. Yeah. I'll just bring you up to speed with a couple of the things that I read in the research that it helps to identify as a Christian, and it's important that we take time to share our faith with unbelievers. Because I think when the kids see parents doing that, they go, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. And to be involved in serving, and even if you can teach others at church, and then be servers in the community, also just do community outreach work.
Right. And so that's where especially the mission involvement shows up, and then serving in the church shows up as something that the parents can do. There are kind of two parts of the study. There are things that are parent actually the parents did something, and then there's the children did something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's divided up into two different parts. I'll mention just a couple other things. As you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, what about friends? Where does that show up? Does it show up?
Mm-hmm.
Did it make the list? And there is an indicator that if the child's best friend was an influence to follow Christ while growing up, that did statistically make an impact, as you can imagine. So that's a positive impact. A negative impact is that the child was rebellious growing up. And so that would say that they had non-Christian friends or friends that weren't walking with the Lord. There's also this thing that for us that are parenting teenagers, if a child did not want to go to church as a teen and we as parents let them make that choice, I think sometimes some of us slip into that, well, you know, they're a teenager now. They get to decide if they want to go to youth group. Those parents who made the decision to lead like that, it shows up as a negative indicator of what they'll be like as adults. So I want to keep that end goal in mind. We're talking about what we can do that affects the spiritual health of children when they're adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I get to make that choice of, yeah, you know what, I don't want to go to church. I want to sleep then. I'm going to skip it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a negative impact. There's also, to me, this is really neat. I come from an intergenerational church. One of the impacts that made the list was that child connected with several adults at church who intentionally invested in them. So that we got to own that as a church. That back to children's ministry, needing workers, back to youth ministry, how can we as adults, as a church, plug into those things? Because it's making a difference for those who have other adults. This means not their parents, because, you know, I know as a mom, I need healthy men and women speaking into my kids' lives so that when they're, like, for example, as teenagers kind of getting hard of hearing in one ear when their parents are talking to
them.
Mm-hmm. They may listen to their Sunday school teachers or their Bible study teachers,
yes,
their small group leaders. And we need that.
That person might say the exact same thing, but they're going to hear it, mm-hmm, from them and not from the parent.
Yeah, exactly. This one was huge to me. Parents typically ask forgiveness when they messed up.
Mm.
And so are we displaying the gospel in our homes? You know, if we fly off the handle and need to go back to our kids and say, you know what, Mama should have, you know, gone to my room and calmed down and said a prayer before I talked to you about.
Yeah, parents don't fly off the handle.
Know?
Yeah.
No, they never do.
No,
right?
They never do.
But if you do, if you are that parent, it pays to actually live out the gospel and ask for forgiveness. You,
mm-hmm,
know, Mama needs Jesus too.
Yeah.
Mama's a sinner too.
Exactly.
And so, will you forgive me? It makes a difference. So, I think those are, parents pointed out biblical principles in everyday life. That goes back to Deuteronomy 6, just as you go along the way. Sometimes I think we get caught up in, we've got to have this Father Knows Best devotional,
mm-hmm,
family devotional time, you know, and now we will have the devotional. Please sit down, children. Daddy opens the Bible. You know, for us, that's like a recipe for hit your brother. I don't know why. As soon as it gets formal and too just structured, it falls apart. Somebody ends up in timeout. And so that Deuteronomy 6 doesn't say that. It says as you go. So for us, a lot of times that means, you know, for all of us, that means there's a lot of car time.
Yeah.
There's some great discipleship moments.
Yeah. Jenna, I'll have to have you back on because I didn't even get to one of my last questions, which was how do we handle money around our kids? Because that's getting to be a bigger concern as well. So we'll get you back on the show. Thanks so much. Congratulations on your book. And it's been a delightful conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Have a great day. Jenna Magruder, thank you so much. We'll take a short break and then we will have a little lighten up with Ken Davis. Be back in a minute.
Absolutely don't share your email address with anyone. We think. We're not very good with the technological stuff. Join us on the Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio.
Good morning. It's half past the hour. The word of the day is slapdash. Slapdash. Done or made without careful planning. Nothing like that ever happens on the Early Morning Late Show. We'll take a break and be back with more in just a minute. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. It pleases God when we put our trust in Him. Pete Wilson talks more about this.
There's nothing more that we want for our kids than to see them trust us. My oldest son turns 14 today, and he's at that age now where he pushes back. He thinks he knows a lot more than Dad does. But there's moments where I'll say something and I can tell that he completely trusts me. He believes what I just said, and he'll do that. And that pleases me. So I can't imagine how pleasing it is to our Father, God, when we trust Him, when we trust His Word, when we trust in His promises, in His provisions, in His power, and we lean into Him. God is a faithful God, and I can trust Him. And, man, that just makes all the difference in the world.
Excellent words from Pete Wilson. If you want to hear that full interview, head over to mindfaithradio.com and check it out. Pete Wilson is his name. Our friend Kim Cattola is on the road and couldn't be with us live today, but we chatted with her yesterday. And at the time of our discussion, the undocumented immigrant teen had not had an abortion. But later in that day, she had that abortion in Texas, ending an eight-week-long court battle. Our conversation at the time did not include that information, but we are going to resume the show with our conversation with Kim in just a few minutes. It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour. So glad you're with us.
The Reformation in England is primarily the story of one man, William Tyndale. This is Jim Garlow remembering the Protestant Reformation. With an extensive education, a master's degree at the age of 21, and a lecturer at Oxford, William Tyndale became focused on a life calling, the translation of the Greek New Testament into English. What Luther had done in Germany, Tyndale determined to do in England. He was under constant threat of arrest, and in hiding most of his life. His revised edition of the New Testament was released in 1534, a spectacular work reflected today in every English version of the Bible. In 1535, Tyndale was arrested and condemned to the stake. His final cry was, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." 2 years later, the King issued a royal injunction making the Bible available in every parish church in England. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Welcome to the show. So glad you're with us today. I have Kim Cattola on our studio line. And Kim is from Cradle My Heart Radio, of course, which can be heard Sunday nights on the Faith Radio Network. Kim, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. Good to be with you.
So there's a lot of news going on with this immigrant teen, the 17-year-old that wants an abortion.
Well, it has become a cause celeb. She's even got a hashtag on Twitter, hashtag justice for Jane. Jane Doe is all we know about the 17-year-old who, you said, as you said, is pregnant. And as I understand it, Bill, she was stopped at the border She did not have papers, and she's undocumented in the United States. So she was sent to a refugee resettlement area for minors. And there she said that she was pregnant. I don't know if she knew she was pregnant coming into the country. But under the Trump administration, the policy is that the refugee resettlement centers don't facilitate abortion. They don't procure an abortion, and they will not drive someone to an abortion. So the 17-year-old Jane got the ACLU involved, and she got a judicial bypass. That's another story for a different day, how that thing works. But the courts said that she has the right to have an abortion, even as a minor, even as an undocumented person in the United States. It's gone back and forth in the courts. She was, I think, 12 weeks pregnant when the case began. Anyway, she's about 16 weeks along now. And the very latest is that a federal appeals court ruled that she can receive an abortion. This ruling came out on Tuesday. And, you know, there's so many things that come into play on this bill. Do you have a constitutional right to an abortion as a citizen? Do you have that right as a non-citizen here in the United States? Do you have a right as a minor without some parental notification? There were efforts to get a sponsor involved. No sponsor could be found. And what's most troubling to me is the way that she has been exploited by proponents of legal abortion, because they're saying that she's, you know, the Trump administration's policy on this and their stand has been that she is free to leave the United States if her pregnancy poses that great of a problem to her. She's, you know, they're not going to hold her, so to speak, because she's pregnant and wants an abortion, but they have an obligation to care for her as a 17-year-old. Well, the ACLU and others are now characterizing that as the U.S. government holding her hostage because the U.S. government is working to protect her unborn child. So it's, for me, it's very tragic that it has come to this. And there, you know, she's emblematic of where things stand with the impasse that we find ourselves in, where people who are advocating for abortion rights refuse to acknowledge the humanity of another human being in the pregnancy. Or if they do, they say, so what? One person's rights trump that person's rights. No pun intended there. You know, trump the child's rights to even be born.
I would think liberals would line up to hand over money to pay for that.
Oh, like I say, if you just look on Twitter on hashtag Justice for Jane, you'll see. And it's troubling. I mean, when you read the tweets and you see the lengths that people will go to deny the humanity of the unborn child, it's very, very troubling. It's gotten a lot of support from the social justice warriors who are claiming, you know, abortion access is a human right.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they, you know, that's how far they're willing to take it, rather than thinking about where human rights come from, right? We have the right to life endowed by our Creator. And if there are no equal rights for all human beings by virtue of our shared human nature, Bill, there's no such thing as equal rights.
You know, Kim, I'd love to become an actor, because that way I could instantly also become an intellectual and political heavyweight, because it seems that the minute a news story pops up like this, people weigh in with their expertise. I know there was an actress, Alyssa Milano, that said preventing an immigrant woman from getting an abortion is a war on women, immigrants, and children.
You know, and her tweet, it comes up on the top of the Twitter feed on Justice for Jane. She's gotten over 4,000 people to like that tweet. Steve Crowder was one who pointed out the fact that war on children is a really ironic term to use when you're discussing having a legal right to kill children in the womb. But I think the irony would be lost on her.
Yeah, I find that interesting as well. All right, there's been a hotly debated tweet by Patrick Tomlinson that posed an interesting question. I think he got eaten alive by that, though, from conservatives. What did you make of that? Let's talk about that, by the way.
Well, we got to consider the source.
I know.
So Patrick S. Tomlinson is an atheist science fiction writer, And when you see, I know some of the people that replied to his tweet, really good-hearted, really kind-hearted believers in Jesus Christ. And you really see, Bill, why the Lord told us not to cast pearls before swine, that we would be trampled. I'm not calling Patrick Tomlinson a swine. I'm quoting the words of our Lord who said,
right.
You know, it doesn't do good to give truth to hard-hearted people sometimes, right? So he tweets out, whenever abortion comes up, I have a question I've been asking for 10 years now of the Life Begins at Conception crowd. In 10 years, no one's ever answered it honestly. And Bill, that's not true, first of all, because this is an old saw. And what he lays out on Twitter is, okay, you're at an in vitro fertilization lab and a fire breaks out. You don't know why, but there's a 5-year-old girl in the building and a vial of 1,000 embryos, I think was the way he laid out the thought experiment, because you can lay it out however you want. So I don't know if the equation changes, if it's 10,000, if it's 1,000,000 embryos. Do you rescue the embryos versus the child?
Right.
I don't know.
1,000 embryos or save the 5-year-old child.
That's the dilemma. That's the moral dilemma. If you say, save the child, this supposedly exposes your hypocrisy as a pro-lifer, that you're not really wanting to defend children. You just want to control women and their reproduction. Well, it doesn't do any such thing. That's nonsense. First of all, to make an argument from this analogy is a logical fallacy. The analogy, first of all, doesn't hold up, especially when we're talking about what abortion actually is, the intentional killing of an innocent human being. Whether or not to rescue someone in an emergency situation is not analogous to intentional killing, first
right.
of all. That's something we have to understand. They don't equate. But secondly, there are many bases under which we could morally save the life of the 5-year-old while regrettably not being able to save the lives of those embryos, which is not inconsistent with holding to the view that life begins at conception. It's really sad that our ability to reason it through is so poor that so many people are giving this guy high fives for having won some sort of moral victory on Twitter with his lame argument. It's just, wow, we really need to reinstate rhetoric and logic classes.
No kidding.
Beginning in first grade, I think.
Yeah, we don't do that much anymore. Kim, let me take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have on our studio line Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart Radio. We're talking about all kinds of pro-life issues and that discussion with this atheist that is just seems a little bit like Swiss cheese. It's I know he's getting a lot of high fives, but it does not hold up in a court of reason or rationale. So I think it's time to move on from that story.
Okay. Well, if you want to know more about how to really, really defeat this lack in logic, go to Public Discourse and look at Robert George's piece on it, because he fleshes it out beautifully and with grace.
Yes.
Much more grace than I'm willing to extend the science fiction guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of science, let's talk a little bit about medical procedures. And I thought George Will really hit a home run here. The Democrats are the real abortion extremists. We're talking about a 20-week fetus that has neurological pathways sufficient for feeling pain. Obviously, there is a bunch of intrauterine medical procedures, some of which involve anesthesia. So the doctors can heal lives that America's extremely permissive abortion law says can be terminated with impunity. In the U.S. here, we say we can still have abortions after 20 weeks. It's not the case in many European nations.
You know, I really like the clarity he brought to this in an op-ed that appeared in the Washington Post. And George Will said, new medical technologies and techniques are lowering the age of viability. That's true. We know that's true, Bill. And increasingly vivid sonograms showing beating hearts and moving fingers make it increasingly difficult to argue that the quote-unquote fetal material is at no point in any way a baby. He said science is presenting inconvenient truths to the party of science. Truths that are the reasons the percentage of pregnancies aborted is smallest since 1973. And, you know, he may be referring there to the fact that when you show a woman an ultrasound, even women who have been shown pictures of fetal development, when you show her the ultrasound of her baby and she hears her baby's heartbeat, the vast majority of those women will choose life and will not go forward even if they had an abortion plan in place.
He says getting a scientific answer to the pain question, even if it is yes, should gratify the party of science. If the answer is yes, those who think fetal suffering is irrelevant can explain why they do.
Oh, my goodness. It's again, it all circles back to what is the unborn? You know, denying the fact that they feel pain or could feel pain, denying the answers that are out there that indicate that they do feel pain is only possible, Bill, if you have it in mind that this is not a human being and not worthy of valuing on any level. And it's clear that that's what they're doing. And so all of their conclusions flow out of that. Mm-hmm. It's easy. Yeah, I guess there's a logical consistency there, but it's not based on science.
And Kim, is it probably good to point out that most European nations restrict abortions by at least week 13? France and Germany are very restrictive after 12 and Sweden after 18. And here in the U.S. of A., we're at 20 or up until the time of birth.
I think what's really at stake, Bill, for abortion rights proponents who insist on abortion after 20 weeks is the fact that that's the point at which fetal anomalies can be discerned on the fetal anatomy check, which is an ultrasound that's pretty standard now at about 20 weeks. It's not possible to diagnose certain conditions. And so what really is at stake here is giving women the right to abort children who have genetic conditions or other, special needs. And it's, again, it's a difficult question when we start considering, how this plays out in the lives of families that get those diagnoses. I don't lack compassion. I don't, dismiss their pain, their suffering, their sorrow at hearing that sort of news. But will we trust God and will we protect the children? Because there's ample evidence that those diagnoses can be wrong. And there's also ample evidence, Bill, that women who decide to let nature take its course, to trust God, whatever reasoning they put behind going forward with a pregnancy when there is a poor prenatal diagnosis, show there are better outcomes psychologically for those women. There's research that exists to prove that than the women who go ahead and abort at doctors' behest, especially after 20 weeks, because that is neither safe nor, it's horrific what has to happen when an abortion happens after 20 weeks. And it's much more difficult for women to recover from it psychologically than going through the pain and sorrow of giving birth and being able to say goodbye to that child under natural circumstances.
And we can continue to actually pray for advances in science, because every time science advances, it makes it more difficult. When a woman is going to look at an ultrasound and call it fetal material if she wants to, at some point she's going to say, oh my goodness, that's a baby.
We have to pray, Bill. And it got impressed upon me just this morning. I pray to end abortion. God could do that tomorrow. And I think in his plan and in his wisdom, he wants to give us the opportunity to be the choice, to be the difference, to be the love that these women and families lack when abortion seems like the only answer. I pray for this Jane Doe in Texas, that she would come to love this child. I pray somehow people will be able to reach her and help her make a choice she can live with for the rest of her life.
Kim, we just have about 90 seconds left. Maybe you could talk about this judge that gave a convicted rapist custody of the son that was born after the woman refused abortion.
Bill, this is also a great story because it teaches us that when we say no abortion after rape, we have to be able to offer help and support and love and care. Save the One is an organization that does that. And Rebecca Kiesling leads that organization. She's an attorney, recently argued a case that there was a rapist who tried to get custody after mom chose life. And the judge ruled in his favor, and then Save the One got involved in the appeal. And of course, justice did prevail, because that's absurd that a rapist would have parental rights, especially when it was established that the rape had occurred. So that decision was overturned. He has no legal custody. And I think that, you know, that's become, again, another political football with abortion rights proponents saying, oh, that's what'll happen to every woman. The rapist will get the baby. No. And if your heart is tendered toward sexual violence victims, as all of us as Christians should be, we should be supporting groups like Save the One that are stepping in to make a difference and help women recover and be restored.
Yeah. Kim, I love your passion and energy, and I always appreciate having you on the show. And I know that it drives people to be much more aware of the needs that are out there in terms of prayer, especially. And also to be active and to take an active role, because that's how things change.
You know, Bill, it's strange to say, but I feel like I'm in the happiness business, because Jesus is our hope.
Mm-hmm.
And as difficult as all these circumstances that we've discovered or that we've discussed today, he's overcome the world. When we trust in him, happy outcomes result.
That is so true. A very pearl of wisdom from Kim Cotola. Thank you so much for being on the show, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Bill.
Yep. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. That wraps up Hour 1. Thank you, Kim. And thank you, Jana Magruder. We'll take a break. When we come back, Peter Kapsner is already in studio. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.